Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let's talk about last night's game. There was so much on the line. Last night in Toronto, a title for the Raptors, the coronation of Kawhi, the end of that dynastic run for the Warriors, or the return of Kevin Durant and the start of the most dramatic comeback in NBA Finals history. So many different storylines, so many different angles, and then what ended up happening was the very worst of any possible result. I mean, that really was sickening last night. That was a complete and utter gut punch. And I don't care whether or not you like basketball. I don't care whether or not you like Kevin Durant. I don't care whether or not you like the Raptors. I don't care whether or not you love Golden State or you hate the Warriors. I don't care about any of that. If you've got any kind of soul at all, it had to be gutted after last night's game. I mean, honestly, watching that, how surreal and terrible was that? The Warriors pull off this amazing comeback on the road. They win. They keep their season, maybe even their dynasty still alive. And yet, that's not going to lead the program. That's not the thing. That's how that night went last night. I tweeted it as well. I have never seen a team so gutted after such an enormous win. I mean, one of the biggest wins of their dynastic run, and I've never seen a team so gutted. Because initially, it was awesome. It started off so great. The first quarter of last night's game was everything you hoped it would be and even more. It started before the game. Like, if you were looking for a moment, a Willis Reed-type moment from Kevin Durant, the pregame huddle in the tunnel told you he was not going to just be limping out there onto the court just for motivation and inspiration. That's not what that was about. If you're watching on CBS Sports Network, that was KD doing his dance, nailing his dance. And then once the game started, the biggest question was, all right, he's out there. But what can we really expect from this guy? He had been off for a month. There was no way he was going to just come right back and start lighting it up, right? Wrong.
Curry to Durant. Here's his first shot. And looks pretty good there. Rattles home a three.
First shot. Pretty good there or perfect. But then again, whatever, right? So he knocked down a three. So he knocked down one shot. No way he does that again. Right? Wrong.
Good ball movement. Draymond over to Klay Thompson. Right side, Durant loads up a three. That's good. KD from downtown.
2-for-2 from deep. Gets to the line for a couple. And then with just over a minute left in the first quarter. Then he did this the next trip down.
Warriors up three with 55 seconds to go. Easy posture for 2-for-1. Durant off a screen, takes a three. It's good for KD.
So I'm watching this, and I'm kind of awed by the whole thing. I mean, this guy, he's got no rust. He's not out of sync. I mean, whatever you expected from Durant, he exceeded it. He smashed it. And just like that, the Warriors were a different team. Just like that, that was a different series. All of a sudden now, Steph is getting open looks. Klay is getting open looks. None of the three could miss, and Golden State was taking it to Toronto. But I'll say this, as well as Golden State was playing and shooting, as much of a lift as Durant gave them, they couldn't shake Toronto. The Raptors were not going anywhere. They weren't folding. That first quarter last night was pure electricity. I mean, hell, I was gassed, and I was sitting on my couch in my living room. Durant was looking good. He was moving well. And while there was a long way to go, it felt like Golden State could rip this thing. Maybe even do the impossible by winning three straight. That's how amazing that first quarter was. That's how incredible Kevin Durant was. That's how much energy they were playing with. That's how much electricity there was. And then the absolute worst thing happened.
Durant off the screen, gets Ibaka as his defender. Durant goes to work, ball knocked away. Durant's hurt. He's hurt. He's hobbling off on the break. Ibaka goes up and got fouled by Livingston.
He's holding his right leg.
Yep.
And it looks like in the same place. I don't want to speculate.
People are cheering an injury.
Warriors radio. Man, that was terrible. The word I used earlier, and I'll use it again right here, that was sickening. You knew the moment he went down, it wasn't just bad. You knew it was the worst. And I've said for years that saying something sucks is not a take, but that sucks. That absolutely sucks. For him, for his family, for his teammates. I mean, for the entire game of basketball, because that's one of the best to ever do it. Coming back from an injury to help his team in the finals, and he ends up paying a huge price. A huge price. The league changed last night because the expectation is it's a torn Achilles, which means we're likely going to go a very long time without seeing Kevin Durant again. Maybe he misses all of next season. I don't know, but it's going to be a long time. And that sucks. Forget Game 5. Forget the rest of the finals. The league is worse off without Kevin Durant. That was a great game when he was on the floor. That was a tease of what that series could have been. And for one quarter, it was amazing. Then, the moment sucked the life right out of the game. It sucked the life out of everything. It completely wrecked it. Again, if you don't love basketball, or if you love basketball, or you love sports, you had to love this guy's return, and you had to love what it represented. Which brings me to Toronto's fans and their initial reaction, which was to cheer the injury. Not all the fans, but for the idiots who did. That was absolutely low rent. The lowest of the low. Absolute Bush League. I will never understand that. And I've been hyping Raptor fans throughout the entire postseason for their passion, for the way they back their team no matter what. An amazing fan base. But for those who were cheering this guy when he was down, that's an absolute garbage moment. Complete and total trash. Especially the losers who were caught on camera waving bye-bye at Durant. I mean, what the hell is wrong with you? How badly is your life gone that you would do something like that? Buying a ticket does not give you license to do that. Nor does it make you a good fan. It makes you an a-hole. It makes you an idiot. Hey, but don't take my word for it. Ask DeMarcus Cousins what he thought about that.
Trash. So trash. But like I said, we only idolize is superstar athletes, not human beings. It's always about what we can do between those lines. That's it. That's all that ever matters. And then once we lash out and, you know, do human type things, then we're considered bad guys.
Or the great Festus Ezeli on Twitter, quote, "I don't care how you feel about KD, Warriors, or about any NBA player. If you ever see someone get injured and you cheer, you're bleeping scum." Pretty much sums it up. Cheering that injury was a scumbag move by scumbags, and if you can't see that, I've got nothing for you. Now, I know they turned it around, and they were chanting his name by the time he left the floor, but that initial reaction was total Bush League. And as much heat as Philadelphia gets for their fans, Toronto ripped a bunch of that last night. I'm not saying all of you. I'm just saying those of you who were. And respect to the Raptor players for getting on their fans for that reaction, but you should not need to tell players, or you shouldn't need players to tell your fans that cheering an injury is a garbage move. Hey, again, I don't care who you root for. Kevin Durant going down with a likely torn Achilles is not a good thing at all. And it sure as hell isn't something you cheer, no matter how badly you want your team to win. You care about the NBA because the guys like Durant. Because the guys can do what nobody else on the planet can do. He makes the game better every time he steps on the court. And if you're cheering his injury, you're making the game worse. Or if you were cheering or people or thinking about defending the people cheering, just look in the mirror. Again, it's not about Durant. It's about you. Now, I'll get into some of the other details in a minute. But if you want to come in here and talk about how that injury impacts free agency and what that means, you're not much better. Man, just give it a moment. Give it a moment. Better yet, give it a rest. Show some respect. Again, a guy who busted his ass to get back on the court, came back, was amazing, and then gets it ripped away from him in a second. And really from everybody. I guess what I'm saying is, saying something sucks is not a take, but that sucks. That truly sucks. And if you can't see that that sucks, you do too. Hey now, are you looking for new ways to get your cardio in during a busy schedule? If you think cycling classes do not make you work up a sweat, you have no idea what you're talking about. You haven't tried Peloton. Why do you think that Men's Health calls the Peloton bike the best cardio machine on the planet? It is. I know. I have one. It's amazing. The Peloton bike is going to make you rethink the way you look at cycling classes because it's an immersive, empowering, heart-pounding cardio experience that you have to try to believe. I had never done anything like it before. And keep in mind, I bought my own Peloton, and I bought it 2 years ago, long before we had a relationship on this podcast. That's how strongly I felt about the product, and it has paid for itself. I love it to this day. And right now, Peloton is offering a limited-time offer. Get $100 off accessories when you purchase the Peloton bike. Get a great cardio workout at home. Go to onepeloton.com and use the promo code Rome and get started. Once again, onepeloton.com and use the promo code Rome and get started right now. I love my Peloton. You'll love yours too. But right now, it is Elk O'Clock. Elk, mate, what's going on? How are you?
G'day, Jimmy. How are you, mate?
Mate, I'm great. The U.S. Open starts on Thursday at Pebble. Where are you right now, Elk, as we speak?
Mate, I am in Stillwater Cove, just to the right of the fourth hole at Pebble Beach. I was just walking down following Jason Duffner, Patton Kazire, and Ricky Fowler for the first three holes, duck in here and do this interview. And I was walking down number three, mate, right out of the gate, big crowd following Ricky and these guys. And this guy in front of me goes, doesn't know I'm there. He says, oh, I just read on the internet that Elk's going to be on Rome. And then he goes, how many times do you think he's going to say heavy muff in the interview? I mean, I almost fell over just walking behind this guy. It was fantastic.
That's incredible. That's one, by the way. Steve Elkington joining us. All right, Elk, that is so good. You've said the word is the course is going to be a mother bleeper, but in a good way. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that? What is a mother bleeper of a course in a good way?
Well, I think, you know, the USGA is, you know, they've had issues with their courses. And finally, mate, we've come back to this legendary place where, you know, in 72, we had Jack win, 82, we had Watson, 2000, we had Tiger win, mate. It's just it's the cradle of American golf, mate. And when we say tough, the greens at Pebble Beach are the smallest set of greens on the whole PGA Tour. And when they get firm, they become even smaller. They're only 4,000 square feet is the average size, and they're tilted from back to front. So when you start to think about hitting balls into these greens when the greens are firm, then, of course, the target size shrinks down a lot. Then they've added, you know, 5.5-inch rough, which, and I was telling my son Sam today, I should have played well in the U.S. Open, but I didn't. And the reason I didn't was I had a terrible attitude about it. I was always pissed off when I came to the U.S. Open because they used to grow 5-inch rough right off the edge of the fairway, and then guys like Hefty and those guys sprayed it everywhere. They didn't have any rough out there 40 yards out into the, you know, way out. Now they do what they call this graduated rough. So if you miss just a yard, it's 2 inches. Then if you miss 5 yards, it's 3 inches. And if you miss 10 yards, it's 5 inches. So, mate, you can't move it 130 yards out of this muff. It's unreal. It's great. I'm just walking in. Fantastic.
Steve Elkins joining us. All right, mate. So if you were to design a golfer around this course and the way it shapes up at this very moment, what kind of a golfer are you looking for? Is it somebody who can bomb it off the tee, or is it somebody who can control it into the greens and then putt like crazy?
Yeah, so this is a different event. The first two events of the majors this year, we've all saw Tiger win the Masters. I predicted it on this show. That's cool. It wasn't any joke that Brooks won at Bethpage, because there was a 350-yard runway for him to hit it on. Here, length, mate, is nullified because these guys, the big hitters like DJ, Rory, Tiger, they're only going to hit three drivers a day. And to get back to your point, it's going to bring in another host of characters. And the other thing I wanted to say was, watching Bethpage, there's not many interesting shot values at Bethpage. In other words, when we watch the Masters, for example, we always enjoy it when they come to number 12. We just love to see that hole, 13, 15. Here's the same way. 7, little par 3, 8 across the gorge. I mean, there's so many other interesting things to watch. But this week, mate, it's all about who's not going to snap. I think the whole thing about Pebble Beach is you're going to get yourself in some bad positions, and there's going to be some runaway shots that are just going to run across the green into more muff. But it's patience, mate. It's hard for me to express to you how quickly you can get your score run up here when you've got this much muff.
That's 4 for you, Elk, but who's counting? Steve Elkington is joining us right now. All right, so go back to the Cat for a minute. The Big Cat won the Masters. You did call it on this show. He missed the cut at the PGA Championship. He finished ninth at the Memorial. How do you think the course sets up for him, and how does his game look to you right now?
Well, I'm not going to make a prediction today, but Tiger will play this course well because the driver stays in the bag, right? So he's going to hit more fairways just because there's bottlenecks, there's dog legs. You run out of runway at Pebble Beach. So, and it's always one on the greens at Pebble Beach. There's Poana, and for people that don't understand what Poana is, it's called Poana. It's a seaside bend. What they do, Jim, is they take about 10 different grasses, like a handful of 10 different seeds, and they put it down on the green. So at different times of the year, some of the grasses perform better than others. And it's a nice surface, but it becomes a little uneven as the day goes on. And I've putted like crap here, mate. I've just done terrible at Pebble because I couldn't putt the Poana. And when I think of guys like Tiger, Phil, Marco Mira won five of these things out here, these AT&Ts, they hit the ball with a little bit more pace with their putter. Like Tiger slams them in. I'm like, how could he do that? So Cat's going to putt well here because he knows the course. Hefty, I don't know what Hefty's going to do. Mate, every time I see Hefty, I feel like he's selling me something, mate. I feel like he's got a long shirt on one day, a short shirt. He's got two drivers, mate. I feel like I'm an infomercial every time I see the guy.
So good. Exactly. So where is he right now, Elk? We're talking to Steve Elkington. He finished top 20 at the Masters. He missed the cut at Quail Hollow. He finished 71st at the PGA. He missed the cut at the Memorial. I mean, exactly where is that walking infomercial as a golfer right now?
Well, I heard he was had two drivers, one to hit bombs and one to hit fairways. Well, he's only got to hit it three times a day, so he doesn't need to. But, you know, I've talked to you about this. You know, we poke fun at Hefty. He wins here when the AT&T. He's not going to win. He's not going to close out the slam this week. He's just not. It's just not going to happen, mate. He can putt, though. The guy can put the speed on those putts, and I just don't see him being that patient right now. He's all interested in hitting these big drives everywhere. Every time I see him, he's on Instagram telling me how far he's hitting it. Mate, he hits it 50 yards behind half the guys out here. Give me a break, Paul.
All right, so what kind of a winning score do you expect to see on Sunday?
Jason Dufter told me if the wind blows a little bit, he thinks it's even par every day is a great score. So I'm saying that 5 under. If we get a little bit of breeze, the greens dry out just a little bit, and the muff's going to grow another inch over the next 4 days. To give you an example, I know a lot of people have played or seen Pebble Beach. The 8th hole at Pebble is probably the greatest par 4 in history of American golf. You hit up onto a top, and then you hit all the way across the ocean down to this little green. It's probably the hardest hole you've ever seen. If you miss the fairway there in the muff at 8, you're not going over the gorse. You got to chip 5 feet sideways back into the fairway. So it's that kind of weekend. It's going to be awesome.
That's 6 for you, Elk. Now you've got a slick new app that I know the clones are going to love. It is the SG Tour Golf Gaming app. What exactly is this, Elk, and when can the clones get it?
Mate, it's up now. SG Tour Golf Gaming in the App Store. Mate, when you think about designing a product, Jim, now that skill-based gaming is legal, golfers, when we go to the course, we stand on the first tee and we say, okay, what's the game and how much you want to play for and what are we going to play, what game it is. So most golfers don't want to be in a betting game with 10,000 other people on the internet. This game is a private game. So what you do, you pick the game you want to play that's in the app. You pick how much you want to do, and then you invite your friends. It's a private game. Mate, Hawkey built a game and invited me, so it can't be real hard to operate.
Wait, Elk, my Hawk? My Hawkey?
Yeah, mate, we're in a $10 winner-take-all, I think, me and Hawk.
You and Hawk.
Yeah, we got more coming.
You and Hawk are peer-to-peer. This is a peer-to-peer app now, right?
Absolutely.
Wow. All right, let me ask you this. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Elk.
Oh, well, I was going to say, and we have a lot of other, it's a true, you know, I'm throwing a big term at you, true two-screen experience where we do all the strategy of Pebble Beach is in there. There's putt predictor where you can use your finger and move the ball. On the greens, we set the pin each day on each one of these 3D greens that you can predict and look at what the putts are going to do. It's awesome, mate. It's fantastic. It's like my best work.
Steve Elkington joining us. All right, so this app's not only about gaming. It's got that feature called the Putt Predictor. Also, like, Elk, can you, is it only about picking a winner? What if, like, I want to say, hey, man, these guys are not going to make the cut. I know they're not. Can I do that?
Yes, we have all different games. The game I think you're referring to is, we have a term, everything we did on the golf, on this app, Jim, is all built for golfers, by golfers. We have a game called Trunk Slammer. You're going to predict four guys to miss the cut. You can pick whoever you want. We're not having that game available this week, but the game that we are playing this week is called a four ball. Everybody knows what a four ball is. We take the field. We split it into four categories done by world rankings, A, B, C, and a D. You pick one from each category. And let's say your A has a par on one, your B has a par on one, your C has a par on one, and your D has a birdie, you're one under as a team. It's an aggregate team event. And you're playing against the people that you invited to your own game. And you split the cash. It's great.
All right, now, Elk, it sounds awesome. You know not all the clones are geniuses. Is this complicated or is it easy to use?
Mate, I just have to rest my case with Hawkey. Hawkey's in.
That's true.
If I can get Hawk into the deal, mate, it's he pretty much represents the averageness of the clone, doesn't he?
Or way below average. The way below averageness of the clones. All right, Elk. So once again, if the clones are not really savvy to this sort of thing, but you've piqued their interest and they want to get the app, how do they go about getting the app?
Go to the App Store. It's search under SG Tour Golf Gaming.
SG Tour Golf Gaming. You want to look for that? Go to the App Store. That is not hard to find. Elk is there. He is a jungle legend. He is a 10-time winner. He is the winner of the 95 PGA Championship. He is the creator of Secret Golf. He is the brain behind that brand new app. Elk, you are locked in. Great job, mate. Appreciate you. Have fun this week, and we'll do it again soon.
Thanks, mate. All the best.
So, how devastating was last night? The Warriors just won that game. They keep their season alive, maybe even their dynasty. Yet they were acting like they lost, understandably, because they lost their teammate. Again, one of the more gutting, brutal finals wins you're ever going to see. Which brings me to something we've already been talking about, Bob Myers. Did you see Golden State GM Bob Myers addressing the media afterwards? He was fighting back tears, trying to control his emotion. He could barely speak.
Kevin had it's an Achilles injury. I don't know the extent of it. He'll have an MRI tomorrow. Prior to coming back, he went through 4 weeks with our medical team, and it was thorough, and it was experts and multiple MRIs and multiple doctors, and we felt good about the process. He was cleared to play tonight. That was a collaborative decision. I don't believe there's anybody to blame, but I understand this world. And if you have to, you can blame me. I run our basketball operations department.
All right, so that's raw. Really raw. And real. Now, you know this is a huge Bob Myers house. He's not just the best at his job, or one of the best at his job. He's one of the best at any job. And you saw why last night. Because the guy cares. Now, if you want to clown somebody for being that emotional, you go ahead and do that. I'm not doing it. This is what I want in a GM. This is what I want in somebody leading an organization. Somebody who's real. Somebody who's not fake. Somebody who cares. And this guy is as real as they come. No, that's not an act. Those were not crocodile tears. He's not putting on a show in an attempt to cover his own ass or to recruit Durant back as a free agent. As always, if this is your reaction, it says a lot more about you than it does Bob Myers. It's just a bad take. If you're going with that, it shows your ignorance. You don't know the guy. If that's your take, you've never heard Bob Myers on this show. You've never heard Bob Myers on our podcast. You've never heard Bob Myers anywhere else. This is a guy who does care about his players. That's never been in doubt. But let's pick up on a couple of things that have emerged from last night and throughout the timeline of that Durant injury. Why don't we start with the idea that some losers started to float that Durant was staying out longer than he had to so he could prove his value to the Golden State Warriors. Like somehow he was not going back because he wanted all of them to know how valuable he is. Garbage. The Warriors already knew how valuable he was. They didn't need any kind of reminder. Ask any one of them in the locker room. Nobody was questioning his value. In fact, again, go to DeMarcus Cousins and ask him what he thought of anybody who questioned Durant's heart.
What do you think about the people who questioned KD's heart and how long it was taking him to return?
F*** them.
Bleep them. Bleep them. And he's right. And then he continued.
It's bigger than basketball here. Outside of these lines, we're human beings just like everybody in this room. We go through things, we have life crises, we have emotions, we have up and downs. It's just when we get in between those lines, we have to zone out all of that and become these superstar athletes. So with that being said, they know us outside of the lines. They know the everyday struggles. They know the adversity and the ups and downs we go through on a daily basis. So with that being said, he's feeling for the guy. It's not about basketball. It's about everything else. That y'all don't care about.
DeMarcus Cousins. And then there was Durant himself, who posted on Instagram, quote, "Dub Nation, gonna be loud as bleep for game 6. I'm hurting deep in the soul right now. I can't lie. But seeing my brothers get this win was like taking a shot of tequila. I got new life. LOL." End quote. So that should answer any of your questions about how connected this guy is to his teammates. Of course, those questions should have been answered when you saw him hanging in the tunnel to congratulate them after wins, or when you saw Andre Iguodala and Steph Curry helping him off the floor last night, or when you saw the emotional reactions from guys like Klay Thompson when they talked about him after the game, or the fact that when Rachel Nichols showed Steph Curry the video of Myers getting emotional at the presser, Curry himself started to tear up and went to find Myers. I mean, honestly, these questions should have been answered a long time ago, but for some reason, they're still out there. And there's also another topic, one that Myers touched on in terms of Kevin Durant being a villain. I don't have time to get into that right now, but I will at some point, because that's been one weird turn. But let's get back to last night and the other absurd ideas that are being floated around, like the one that somebody's got to be blamed. Somebody has to be blamed, and the Warriors rushed him back. And somehow, it might be all part of a larger conspiracy theory. So, who should be blamed? Is it on the medical staff? Is it on Durant? Is it on Bob Myers? How about this? We don't know. Maybe it's not on anybody. Maybe it's nobody's fault. All right, so you want to point to the fact that he played 12 of the first 14 minutes. Yeah, that's cool. But how did he look in 12 of the first 14 minutes? Pretty damn good, right? So if you want to come in here and bang that drum, you better have proof that you were saying just that in the first quarter, that he'd already played too many minutes. And even then, you'd be lying to yourself. Like, if they only played him, say, 6 minutes in the first 14, who's to say that he doesn't get injured in the 7th minute of 15? In other words, if you're looking for a conspiracy theory, keep moving. You're telling me that Golden State, I mean, I'll play along, conspiracy theory. You're telling me that Golden State tricked Kevin Durant into playing. Is that what you're saying? They had multiple doctors and experts and MRIs, and they went over all of this over the past month. But somehow, they tricked Durant and his family, and his camp, and the people around him into playing. Golden State, the same team that held Klay out of Game 3, is a safety precaution, even though they knew it would cost them that game, and he insisted on playing. But that same group is going to fool Kevin Durant into playing Game 5, after they waited patiently for him for more than a month. Oh, all right. Sure they did. So if you're going to come in with that kind of garbage, you better have proof that the Warriors bullied Durant into playing. Just don't come in here and throw that crap up against the wall and expect it to stick. Now, could they have handled this differently? Maybe. Possibly. Anytime somebody's coming back from an injury and then they suffer an even worse injury, then there's going to be a review. And maybe they would want to do things differently. Maybe. You could see stories that come out later on that go to that point. But we don't know. This is not the first time a guy's come back from an injury and then gotten re-injured. It happens a lot. Maybe not on this stage. Maybe not to a guy on that caliber. But it happens all the time. So if you want to argue that if Durant doesn't play last night, he doesn't suffer an injury, that's fine. But by that rationale, no player should ever play. Like, if you never play, you'll never get hurt. The moment you step on the court or a field, there's always going to be risk of injury. And when you're coming back from injury, the risk is higher. So, it's all about limiting risk. But you can't be perfect. There are no guarantees. You can't guarantee a guy won't get re-injured. And by the way, how about this? What would have been said about Durant all summer long if he didn't play last night? If he never played in the finals and Golden State lost? How many people would then be questioning his heart? But now you've got the same losers who would have questioned his heart who are questioning his decision to return. It's a hell of a lot of unknowns. And watching him go down last night was pretty emotional for most people. I just know that it sure seemed like there were a lot of clowns on Twitter who suddenly got their PhDs and got board certified to practice Twitter medicine in a matter of moments last night. Like I said, from loser to orthopedic surgeon in 1 second flat. Twitter is funny like that. And by funny, I mean completely jacked. When Twitter is good, it is great. And when it's bad, it's, well, that. And saying Bob Myers faked that emotion to cover himself and to re-sign Durant is a bad take. Just a bad take. It's an ignorant take. You don't know the guy. I know the guy a little bit because he's come on this show so many times and he's come on our podcast and I've sat with him in person. Man, that guy is not fake. Never do anything like that. It's ignorant. Let me talk to you about my pals at Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats is an online event ticket marketplace which is dedicated to providing fans of live entertainment with experiences that are going to last a lifetime. With Vivid Seats, you can watch your favorite teams and artists perform in person, live. Vivid Seats help you find seats to any of your favorite live events, including sports, concerts, theater, and so much more. And Vivid Seats offers great prices and an easy purchasing experience. Vivid Seats is the presenting sponsor of Smack Off 25, the Silver Anniversary Smack Off. They're the very best, and they offer experiences which will last a lifetime. Once again, every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Download the app or visit VividSeats.com. Again, download the app or go to VividSeats.com. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime. Let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. Check out my pals at Vivid Seats. Chris Woodward is my guest. Chris, good to have you on. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Jim?
Good, good. Lots to cover, but let me ask you about last night. You beat Boston 4-3 in 11 innings. I want to get into some of the details of the performance you got from your starting pitcher, Mike Minor. But overall, how pleased were you with the way the team battled last night?
You know, it's not surprising for me. These guys, we talked about it, from spring training on, just how important it is to be resilient. And, we use the word relentless a lot, and that's something that has defined our ball club, and it started off in the first couple series of the season, and it's kind of snowballed into what it is now. It's our guys believe, no matter what the score is or how many we're down, or we're going to put up a fight and give ourselves a chance to win a game. So you saw that last night, and tough ballpark, obviously, and our guys loved it, man. They loved the energy there, and came up with a win.
Rangers manager Chris Woodward joining us. All right, so back to Minor. He didn't get the decision last night, but he did go head-to-head with Chris Sale, and he went 8 innings. He allowed 4 hits, 2 runs. He struck out 6. When you're a starting pitcher, every time you take the mound, it's a chance to make a statement. What kind of a statement did he make last night?
I think going into the game, it was, RAs versus their ace, and, we all know Chris Sale. You know, he's one of the nastiest pitchers in baseball, and our hitters knew that. We prepared heavily for him. But you know, I think Mike kind of took that as a chip on his shoulder to kind of show the league that he's not too bad himself. And you know, after giving up two runs in the first two hitters, what he did after that, you know, obviously put eight zeros up after that, and you know, got us within one through eight, and you know, we ended up pulling it out in the end.
So, Chris, the team was coming off a 67-win season last year, which is going to take a toll on everybody. When you first arrived, you were talking about the process and focusing on that and not the results. What was your mindset coming into this season?
I use the word champion a lot. I'm trying to get these guys to understand that, you know, from what I've witnessed in my career and you know, the things that I believe in that create winning cultures and winning ball clubs, you know, you have to be a champion in every sense of the word. Everything we do on and off the field, you know, every one of our processes, whether it's, you know, going to the batting cage or what you eat that day, what time you go to bed that night, all those things factor into your performance. And, you know, game planning and studying and teaching these guys to think on a much higher level. I think it's a process. I mean, you know, we know that guys are where they are, and we just keep pushing them forward. And I think that these guys have embraced that. And at the same time, you know, the end goal is to win a game. And, you know, I believe if you're ready to go out there, you're prepared, you've done everything you can actually enjoy that process of playing the game, of competing at the highest level and going toe-to-toe with the best. And, you know, I don't shy away from expectations or shy away from, you know, what's staring us right in the face. And, you know, I talk about that a lot, and I want our guys to embrace that.
Texas Rangers manager Chris Woodward joining us here in the Jungle. Now, at the same time, you are in second in the AL West. You're five games over 500. From the outside, it would seem like you might even be running ahead of schedule. Does it feel that way to you, or is this pretty much what you expected?
You know, listen, I want to win. I want to win a World Series this year. I said that many times. But, you know, where we are right now, I try not to get caught up in the wins and losses. And, you know, obviously I know exactly where we're at. You know, we're two games ahead of these guys. We're two games ahead of Cleveland. I'm not shy about that. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to lose sight of where we are in our processes, in our belief, and as far along as these players have come, you know, we still have a long way to go to get to our ultimate goal. And that's, you know, just being a fine-tuned machine that, you know, every time we step on the field, we feel like we're the best team. And, you know, that's something that I want our players to keep striving forward. As a group and then also as individuals, you know, they have their own individual goals that they want to achieve and get to, and we're helping them get there. But it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort, you know, from our staff. We have a tremendous staff, tremendous organization, you know, backing all these guys, and I think the players feel that.
Chris, listen, I don't want you to have to pick up the name that I'm about to drop. However, I've been texting with a guy that you know pretty well the last couple of days. Just out of pure coincidence. If we were to go back a little bit, because your journey to this point is really pretty remarkable. You're from Covina, California, and you knew my guy Michael Young back in the day. When did you first meet him, and what did you think of him as a player and a person?
You know, I don't know what age. I knew of him when I was probably 8 or 9. I mean, he was by far the best player growing up in my area, in Covina. And we went to junior high school together, and that was kind of the first time I think maybe I met him and actually, you know, became friends with him. I think we may have played against each other at some point before that. But he was honestly like a legend growing up. He was, like I said, head and shoulders above everybody else. And when I got a chance to actually go to school to him, get to know him a little bit, and I got to know who he was. Pretty cocky as a kid, you know, and I know he's it's amazing talking to him now and just seeing the quality of the person. Like, I knew he was a good guy and he's a good friend, but what he is now, I mean, you know, he is heavily beloved, obviously, in the Texas area and especially in Arlington, as one of the greatest, you know, Texas Rangers ever play. And it's been awesome to get back in touch with him and kind of reconnect. And we kind of go over old stories, and they've had us, you know, do a few things together and talk about old times. So it's been fun kind of rekindling that those old memories that I have of when we were young. And at one point I actually lived within two blocks of them, you know, growing up. So we definitely go way back, but I'm not surprised by any of the success that he had because he was such a good player growing up.
Yeah, listen, I appreciate your thoughts on him. Now, this guy's an absolute stud, both on and off the field. But again, you were not too shabby yourself. I did mention off the top, you were taking in 54th in 1994. You not only made it to the majors, is it true that you got there before Young? And if so, how often did you let him know about that?
I let him know about that. That was something that, it, you know, not a lot of people realize, but it meant a lot to me because of how good he was. He went to UC Santa Barbara. I went to 1 year junior college.
Yeah, he did.
You know, by the time I got to the big leagues, you know, we actually got drafted by the same team. So he signed with the Blue Jays, but I was a year ahead of him because I was already in the organization. So he got traded to Texas. I don't know, it was 2000, but I got to the big leagues a year before him. And in 2002, the first year he actually got a chance to play on an everyday basis, I had a better year that year. And then the rest of his career was much, much better than mine. I definitely tell him about that every time I see him.
Yeah, I want to be very clear about this. Not 54th overall. You were taken in the 54th round, and although he was a legend in the area and one of the best players you saw growing up, you did beat him to the major leagues. Now, and I mentioned UC Santa Barbara. You did. I went there as well. That's why he and I were texting. We've got a really, yep. really good coach at UC Santa Barbara by the name of Andrew Checkitz, who's getting a lot of attention from other schools. So we were kind of chopping that up a little bit. Now, by one count, you played for 11 different managers in the majors, and a number of them were first-time managers. What kind of an impact did those managers have on you and how you approach your job right now?
Yeah, I think it definitely helped. When I got done playing, you know, I started my last couple of years, I wrote down a lot of my beliefs and philosophies. I knew I was going to get into coaching. So I started writing down things that were dear to me and how I would do things, you know, from a coaching standpoint and from a managerial standpoint, organizational standpoint. And so I, you know, kind of looked back and remembered all those, and I didn't realize it at the time, until I started writing down all the names, and I realized, holy cow, like there's a lot of not only managers, but like first year managers, which, you know, is kind of odd. Not a lot of guys play for that many first year managers, like 9 or 10 first year managers. So, you know, you kind of take from each one, you kind of understand, okay, I like that about that. I like that about him, about that about him. I didn't like that. So you kind of just, you know, put things together and develop an understanding of, you know, what I value and what I feel like, you know, players would value overall. And it really helped me. Obviously, I played for Wakamatsu, who's my bench coach now. I mean, he's one of my dear friends, and he's my right-hand man right now. So it's great to have that next to me. He's one of the better managers I played for. Bobby Cox, there's a bunch of guys. I mean, John Gibbons, you know, Carlos Tosca, there's so many of them. Tito actually played for Terry Francona in Boston for a month. So I got to see a lot of different ideas and different philosophies, different ways of doing things. So it really helped me create my own.
Hey, Chris, Tito's an all-timer. Did you spend enough time playing for him to get anything significant from him? Like, what was that month like? Is it only a month, or could you really learn something from him in that month's time?
I did, because we were, you know, it was the last month of the season, so we were in a playoff race. I think it was 2009, and, you know, we won the wild card that year. But, you know, just seeing how he handled the clubhouse, you know, listening, talking to the players, hearing their input about him. Because I was curious. I was like, man, this guy's been successful. Like, what makes him successful? Why do these players pour their heart and soul out on the field for him? And I got to know that right away. Like, once I started talking to guys, I talked to Pedroia, you know, talked to a bunch of different players that they gave me their kind of input about it. And, you know, he made you feel, you know, it's amazing how easy he made it feel to play the game, especially in a city like Boston. That's, you know, you got the media and you got everything. There's high expectations every year, and he kind of deflected all that and made the players feel like they can just go out and play their butts off. And I really appreciated that, and I actually felt really good. I didn't really play a whole lot, and I didn't do much, but when I went out there wasn't an ounce of anxiety or nerves about playing, you know, here, because of the way he made you feel. And I took a bunch of money from him playing cribbage. I do remember that. He wasn't the luckiest cribbage player, but I got him a few times, and he had to write me a couple of checks at the end of that year.
Oh, dude, that's so good. That is so good. So was cribbage a thing in that clubhouse, or is cribbage a thing in a lot of clubhouses?
At the time, it was in a lot of clubhouses. I don't see it as much now. You don't see the board come out very often now for some reason, so... That was the first thing I saw. You know, I got designated by Seattle and got picked up by Boston. And the first thing in Yankee Stadium, Boston, New York, I walk in. It was like 6 p.m., you know, 7 o'clock game. And I walk in there, and Pedroia's playing Francona in cribbage. You know, and I was like, hey, I'm like, how you doing?
What the hell is this? Yeah. That's amazing. Like, when you say the cribbage board doesn't come out very often, I've never seen it come out anywhere in any walk of life except for my father-in-law, and he was like 90.
Right, it's like backgammon. No, it is one of those things. I actually played a lot of cribbage as a younger big leaguer. It was kind of the game. You know, you just pull out the pegs and let it eat. But for some reason, he loved that game, and him and Pedroia would play it all the time.
Yeah, whatever the skip likes, man, I like it. I'd give anything to see Tito and Pedroia playing cribbage. That's good. Texas Rangers manager, he was named Andrew back in November, 54th round pick in 1994, and they are playing really good ball right now. Chris, great to have you on the show. Appreciate that conversation. Let's be sure we do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jim.
From Smackoff 25, I started this countdown clock when we were 50 days out. It is already down to 10. Yesterday, I went hard on this year's golden ticket class. I warn them they better use these days wisely. Do everything they can to make sure that they get themselves in a position where I'm going to want to take that phone call. Just getting in the field does not mean you're going to get on the air. And also in terms of the Schmacky Choppa, you probably think to yourself, if I don't do anything stupid, he can't rip that ticket. Yes, I can. Absolutely, I can. In fact, not doing anything between now and then is doing something stupid. Because you're not giving me a reason to take your phone call on that day. It's cowardly. It is. I mean, I don't want to call somebody a coward. It's cowardly. Dan in Denver not only heard me, but he called right up, bobbed and weaved his way through the blades of the choppa, and actually gave me a reason to make room for him on the 21st. Credit to him. It was a smart call. Now, what about the other 8 of you? 10 days, again, does not mean 10 shows. 10 days means 8 shows, including this one. And this one is more than half over. Get at it. Your time is running out. And my time to profile the players is also running out. Now, back when I started these profiles, the question was, where is Mike in Indy? Then Mike showed up. Now, albeit he did show up selling a spot on his call for $5,001, but he did show up. So I know exactly where Mikey is. The question then shifted to, where the hell is Vic? Where is the 2010 champ? Where is Broadway Victor? Where is Broadway? Smackoff season is Vic in no-cal season. But not this year. Not yet, at least. Fact of the matter is, I have not heard from Vic since February. Back when he told me what Hill, Brad in Corona is willing to die on.
There are certain guys in the jungle who are consistent with a brand, you know? Like Brad in Corona called recently to talk at length about circumcision, and that was predictable. I mean, the guy has made his choice, you know? It's been a decade now since Mike DiTola pointed out Brad's creepy, super bad-like obsession with the male unit, but Brad, much like Tom Brady, is still going as strong as ever, you know? It's kind of admirable. I mean, the man is dedicated to his craft, you know? He's committed. He has made his choice about what hill he's willing to die on, and that hill is Dong Hill.
Now, before that phone call in February about Brad being willing to die on Dong Hill, Vic renewed his rivalry with Rick in Buffalo by taking a run at the Buffalo Clone Stock, which was held at the beginning of 2019 at a Sabres game.
You're not getting over, Bonk. You're a fat 50-year-old junior high teacher in Buffalo with a giant head, dude. You're not getting over. Okay, I mean, Rome, did you see the pictures of that Buffalo convention of dorks that Rick organized at the Sabres game? Jesus, man. Yeah, what a collection of winners that was. I mean, Rome, you know I love your show. I got your back. But I will never go to a sporting event while carrying around a Jim Rome show sign with me, okay? And that's because I want to have at least some semblance of a chance of ever seeing a vagina again.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call. I can't lie. I had forgotten he said that. Or maybe I just conditioned myself to forget crap like that. That's why you might have caught my reaction on CBS Sports Network. I had forgotten that he did that. Now, Vic's been doing things like that for a long, long time. Let's go way back. His first Smackoff call was way back in 08. And last year, he made it to his 11th straight main event when he did this.
Little Alvy's an animal. Dude, that guy gets more ass than Kelly Clarkson's Lazy Boy. Little Alvy multiplies like a Catholic rabbit. maybe he can help out Caleb in Green Bay, man, because the only women in Caleb's life are Betty Crocker, Little Debbie, and Wendy. I mean, look, I'm not saying Caleb isn't skilled with the ladies, but if he were a Star Wars character, his name would be Han Solo. I mean, my man Caleb has such little game, and he's so fat that he doesn't invite chicks over to his pad to Netflix and chill. He invites them over to Netflix and grill. No wonder my man was trying so hard to win that master built.
This is Vic, right? This guy's taking shots at everybody during his decade plus in the jungle. And man, this guy can be a savage at times. And I mean everybody. Even people that I wish he would not take runs at. Like the time he went after the legend that is Ray Ratto.
Memo to you, Ratto. I'm having a hard time hearing you talk about sports and athletes when you're sitting there with that silly little walrus mustache, that grotesque double chin of yours that hangs down to your nipples like a pelican beak. My man, you look like Craig Stadler ate Jabba the Hutt and then squeezed into a Cosby sweater. And that haircut, Ron, that ridiculous haircut that's like straight out of a Bob's Big Boy. It's absurd, Ron. I mean, what kind of grown-ass man walks around with that kind of hair, man, you know? I can almost see his mom fixing little Raymond's hair for him every morning before she pats the 50-year-old virgin on the head and sends him off to work, you know? The point is this, Ratto, not to go all you never played the game on you, but you never played the game. I doubt you ever played any game. I think the only game Ratto ever played, Rome, was Hungry Hungry Hippos, a game that he still enjoys playing to this day, except, of course, nowadays he just calls it lunch.
Jeez, Vic. Ray Ratto is a legend. This is an enormous Ray Ratto house. Always has been. Always will be. Why do you gotta be like that, Vic? What a savage. But Vic does what Vic wants to do. No better example of Vic's blatant disregard for everybody than when he went in hard on a former Smack-Off competitor a few years back.
Did Jay Moore seriously just spend 5 minutes talking about me? Are you kidding me, Jay? Was that supposed to be some kind of kill shot? Dude, that was a pathetic effort, fat man. Look, it's not my fault your show got canceled, Jay. Your show got canceled because it was awful. I mean, I watched it once, Rome. It was so bad, it actually made me want to go read books. Straight up. Jay, don't hate me because my smack is beautiful. Don't hate me just because you're such an unprofessional and unprepared buffoon that you show up 15 minutes late to host a national radio show. It's not my fault, Jay. It's not my fault that you've been reduced to hawking DiGiorno pizzas and kissing Justin Bieber's ass in the hopes of being able to pay your rent, all right? Talk about a fall from grace, man. I actually remember the days when you were an edgy comedian with balls. Dude, you're an absolute mess, man, between your panic attacks, your failed marriages, your canceled TV shows, your meltdowns on Twitter. You're a mess in more ways than I can count, Jay, and I can pretty much count to infinity. Face the facts, Jay. You will never be better than me in life. You will never be better than me in this jungle, okay? The only jungle you will ever be better than me in will have to exist in some alternate reality. I gotta go, man, because Jay's charred carcass is setting off my smoke alarm. Let me go urinate on him.
This is what you get with Vic. I mean, this dude is an assassin. No mercy. He does make the smack off better. This is why I'm asking again, where is Broadway Vic? And I'm hoping he makes it 12 straight years and makes a run at a second title. I'm still looking for that RSVP call, or RSVP call Vic. You know, the RSVP call that you invented.
Rome, this is not a RSVP call. This is the RSVP call. Dude, I invented the RSVP call. I invented clones interacting on social media. I'm the single most influential force in the jungle in the past 20 years. Everywhere you look in the jungle, you see my influence.
Vic, I'm looking, but I do not see you right now. Not yet. Not yet. Now, we do have 10 days. 10 days and counting. And as I've said before, the new question on everybody's mind is, where is Broadway? Donde está Broadway? I'm joined in studio by Dodger outfielder Alex Verdugo. Alex, it is good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Are you impressed with my studio?
Yeah, I love it, man. It's a
That's
lot
not
different.
What you said when you came here, man. You're like, dude, I thought this was much bigger.
Oh, hey, I'm gonna let the fans in on a secret. This brick right here, it's not even real brick.
That's a lie, man. Hey, actually, it might not be. It might not be real. I knew I shouldn't have brought you in here, man. This is what happens, man. Guys always calling me out. You're right, though. You're exactly right. The thing reads well on TV. All right, so you dropped a tough one to the Angels last night. I know that you're not pleased with the result, but Angel Stadium was packed for that game. Man, how fun is it to play in a game in June when you have that kind of energy and that kind of juice?
It's amazing. I mean, you know, just obviously we want to go out there. We want to win every day. That's the goal. You know, that's what our organization preaches. But just to go out there and even on road games, home games, like when we have 40,000, 50,000 fans, it's one of those things, man. You step out there to the box, you step out there on the field, and it just hits you different. You get a different feeling inside. You have a natural adrenaline that just kind of comes with it.
I was going to say, Alex, watching you play, I've got a feeling like you have that adrenaline, that energy, no matter where you are, regardless of the stadium, regardless of how many people there are there. In fact, a big part of the atmosphere in the clubhouse, Kike Hernandez said of you, this is what he said about you earlier, quote, he's very unique. So far, we have welcomed it with open arms. He's playing his ass off for us. Whatever it takes for us to win, as long as he's not taking it to an extreme where it's borderline disrespectful to anybody, he's not doing any of that, so it's been a lot of fun to watch so far. So my question is this. How important is it for you to bring that energy day in and day out and know that your teammates can count on that juice and that lift no matter what you're doing at the plate?
Yeah, you know, it's big. It's one of those things you want to stay consistent. Baseball players, we talk about it a lot, about riding the roller coaster. You know, you want to stay in the middle. For me, you know, being a high energy guy, I kind of wear my emotions on my sleeve. I show it when I get frustrated. I like to show it, you know, just. It's something that I've always played with. It's the passion. You know, I love this game, and I always want to succeed and, you know, be the guy who comes through for the team. So I hold myself very high to that. But, yeah, like Kike said it great, you know, it's just there is a point where, you know, you kind of go too much about yourself to where it does get disrespectful or you kind of are taken away from the team. So for me, I try to find that happy medium. And, you know, you want to let out your frustration, but you also want to, you know, flip the switch and get back to it and, you know, kind of reset.
Dude, you want to use the fuel. If you want to use the fuel, it's kind of like Draymond Green. Like, I have to know how to channel it. You want to use that fuel, not show anybody up or anything like that. And I know you don't want to make it about yourself, but let me ask you this. I mentioned off the top, you're ninth in the All-Star voting. At the moment, you need to stay in the top nine to advance to the next round of voting. Again, you're not focused on the personal honors, but how much would it mean to you to be in that top nine and what would it mean to advance?
It means a lot. You know, it's obviously one of the goals as being an athlete and a player. You want to, you know, through the course of the season, you want to win a World Series, but you also want to win these little things, you know, All-Star, Silver Slugger. You know, there's various awards that you can get, Gold Glove. So for me, you know, it's cool to even know that I'm ninth in it right now. I've been on a little bit of a struggle just where my average has dropped. So, you know, the fact that I can flip the switch and get hot again and kind of, you know, boost those numbers back up. Well, it's good to know.
Alex Verdugo joining me in studio. Dave Roberts said of you last year, quote, he can essentially do anything on the baseball field. And we're talking about Dave Roberts here now. What's it mean to you to hear that kind of praise from your manager?
A lot. I think it's something, you know, I've always kind of had like internally where I've always wanted to be the best. I've always wanted to, you know, my game, I never feel like it's done growing. I always want to improve in every aspect. And, you know, whether it's offensively hitting for more power or just, you know, getting base hits to stealing bases or making a play in the outfield, I've always, you know, wanted to be a complete all-around player and help the team no matter what.
So part of that's working on your mind. Part of that's working on your body. Back in February, you posted an Instagram pic of you with the legendary Gil Reyes. You and I were talking about this off the air. Man, I love Gil Reyes. I haven't talked to him in a number of years, but back when Gil was working with Andre Agassi, those guys would have me out to the events. Gil would hang out. He'd come on the program. God, I love this guy. I know he's somebody you work out with quite a bit. How did that relationship first start?
Yeah, just through one of my cousins. He was working with Andre, and you know, I was like 15, 16 years old, and, you know, I was able to go out to Vegas and kind of just introduce myself to Andre and Gil and go to his gym and, you know, just touch base, just kind of like get to know each other. And, yeah, just I threw down from the first day I went there, and every day I go there, I throw it down. And, you know, for Gil, he loves that. He loves to see the heart. He wants to see you fight. And, you know, for me and him, when we get in there, it's a lot more than just working out. It's also, he's my mentor. He's like a father figure to me. So He's really guided me in the right steps.
He did the same thing for Andre Agassi, who was an amazing, amazing athlete, a Hall of Famer. What was your impression when you first met Andre? What was he like?
I mean, the most humble, nicest, genuine guy you can get. Like, you know, it's just, he truly cares about you. And through all his success, you know, how big he has been in tennis and, you know, what he's done outside of it, it's just for him to stay as humble as he has and, you know, he'll talk to anybody as if he's known him for years. And it's just, it's special, man. It's really fun.
Yeah, something that keeps coming up too is the fact that Gil grew up listening to the Dodgers on the radio. I grew up the same way in L.A. I grew up in L.A. listening to the Dodgers on the radio. So you're not just playing Major League Baseball. You're playing Major League Baseball for the L.A. Dodgers. So what's it mean to you not only to be a major leaguer, but to be a Dodger?
It means everything. You know, for me, it's just, I wouldn't want to be with any other organization. It's just, you know, I was drafted with the Dodgers. I grew up through the system with them. And, you know, just being up here, being with the guys and our fan base, it's nuts, man. This is the place to be. LA is amazing. And, you know, our fans, they get behind us and they have our back. And, hey, like, you know, you do a couple of good things and you kind of start blowing up. So it's this is definitely the spot that you want to be at.
Yeah, Alex Verdugo joining me for a couple of more moments. And then you've got these great rivalries. You've got the Dodgers, Angels. You're getting that on tonight. How about the Dodgers and Giants? Again, man, it can be cliche, but you really do throw all that crap out. It doesn't matter. When those two teams get together, man, there's some legitimate hate. And I don't just mean the fans. Well, you tell me, what's the rivalry like from a player standpoint?
Player standpoint, man, it's just really, it's kind of one of those things. As soon as I was drafted with the Dodgers, we kind of like, they preach, you know, hey, the Giants, we don't like them. Like, you know, we every time we play them, we beat them.
And they don't
beat
like us.
Down.
We don't like them. They don't like us.
Exactly. So it's just, it's one of those things. And it's for us, when we go up play there, we don't care about the record. If they're doing good or bad, like, we just go there. We know it's the Giants and we want to beat them down. So that's really our mindset.
I like it. It's a SoCal native because, believe me, they hate our guts. They hate our guts. So when you see Max Muncy turn Mad Bum around the way he did, dude, he wasn't two steps out of the box before that red ass was coming for him. And nothing but respect, man. I love Mad Bum. He's unbelievable. But your dude was not two steps out of that box before he was John Adam. What did you think when you saw that?
Yeah, I mean, I was a little fired up by it too, because obviously Muncy, when he hits it, he drops a bat, you know, like that. But I thought it was, I didn't think he pimped it bad at all. You know, at I didn't all. Think he looked at it. I thought he hit it, knew it was gone, dropped the bat, and started running. And, you know, but Bumgarner, second pitch of the game, he was already John at the umpire. So I think he was already a little mad. It was a day game, so he was already, you know, a little grumpy. But but no, it was kind of also good. I think it kind of woke us up and, you know, kind of gave us that adrenaline and we woke up quick for it.
You know, exactly. And again, I've got nothing but respect for what he's accomplished. But what do you make of him or any other pitcher at this point saying, hey, man, put your head down and just run?
I mean, I feel like that's their view. You know, I feel like if I was a pitcher and I was pitching and someone hit a bomb off me, I'd be upset about it too. But that's the competitor in me. You know, it's like I want to be better than the guy I face. So for him to do it, like, I'm not mad at it, but maybe not get too fired up about it if it's that, like, little of a pimp. Like, I would understand if he stood in the box, it landed into the, you know, the ocean, and then he ran. But it looked fine to me.
Dude, if he went Barry Bonds pirouette, or he went Jeffrey Leonard one flap down, or he went backwards around the bases, that'd be one thing. You're exactly right. He just kind of flipped the bat a little bit and started to go.
Yeah, but I mean, hey, if you hit him like that, you deserve to do whatever you want.
All right, so back on Mother's Day really quickly, your mom, Shelley, was one of four mothers who threw out the first pitch. She said beforehand she wasn't sure she'd be able to pull it off, and she fired one right to you. What did you make of her pitch, and what was that like to be out there with her?
It was amazing. It was special. Her pitch, I thought she had the best pitch. You know, I thought it was a strike on the corner.
A little movement?
Yeah, it was funny because, you know, the night before, we were actually in my house, and she was throwing a baseball in my living room, you know, with my family.
Was she practicing?
Yeah, she was practicing. Like, she thought, so if I step here, and I just told her, I said, Mom, If I'm right in front of you, just step towards me and just try to throw it.
Dude, what was she like when you were coming up and growing up and playing ball? Was she there? What was she like?
She was. My mom was absolutely like a trooper about it. You know, I was a pitcher too growing up. So, you know, 15 years old, I was getting 88, 90. You know, and my mom would be like, I would have to throw, and my mom would be like, hey, let's go in the backyard, throw to me, and then she like, I'll get the catcher's gear on. And I was like, Mom, you're crazy. Wow. You're crazy. Like, no way.
I love it. Dodgers Angels tonight. That game is at 7:07 p.m. Pacific. He is ninth in the All-Star voting right now. If he stays there, he advances to the next round. Alex, what did I tell you, man? Piece of cake. Just like that. Good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Good to see you. Let's do it again soon, all right?
Yes, sir.
Be good. Alex Verdugo. So the reaction is what you'd expect. A lot of hate. A lot of hate. Some love. And then some people who just didn't get it. Adam, throw the cans on. Now, as we know, especially because of CBS Sports Network, people find the show that ordinarily don't know the show. Tell me about the one caller who wanted to come on and talk about what he thought about Vic.
Yeah, after you profiled Vic, we had someone call in, talk to me. He was very distraught, very upset, and he said he would like me to pass a message on to you that he doesn't want to hear those calls anymore because they're rude and they're not nice. And he would really like you to stop playing the rude, not nice phone calls.
Well, it was rude. It was not nice. The guy's right about that. What the hell show does he think he's listening to?
Apparently, he's heard this show before because he said it's a great show. I know. I didn't think so either.
He said it's a great show.
Yeah, he said it's a great show, but that call was very rude and not nice. And he would like you to stop playing those calls immediately.
Well, yes and no. I mean, he's right about the call, the tape. But I'm not going to stop doing it, right? If that guy didn't like that, can you imagine that guy trying to sit through a smack off?
I hope he tunes in June 21st. That would be great.
All right. Thanks for sharing that. All right. So that's always curious to me. Like, hey, I really like that show, but hey, man, that was not cool. That was not nice. That was rude. You're not making the world a better place. Yeah, actually, I'm trying to eradicate that sort of thing. Well, maybe not that sort of thing. What show do you think you're listening to? I almost brought back nice radio. Back in the day, every once in a while, I would get a call like that from somebody who would say something like that. Like, man, why is that guy like that? Why did that person make that phone call? That was not nice. That was rude. That was uncalled for. That was unnecessary. Why do you do that? That's irresponsible. How are you on the air, and why do you allow that? It's your show. And then I would say, you know what? You know what? You're right. I think it's getting away from me. I think we're too caught up in this whole concept of the jungle. We should treat each other the way we would like to be treated. That is unnecessary. That is uncalled for. We don't need to do that. Let's lift each other up instead of beating each other down. And that was the statement that I made back then. And maybe now we need that more than ever before, especially with the cesspool that is social media. All the garbage, all the vitriol, all the hate, garbage. All the anger. Why is everybody so angry? You know what? Maybe this guy's right. Maybe what we really need is a good dose of nice radio, where we only say nice things. We only say positive things, and we will not tolerate any negativity, any venom, any vitriol, any disrespect, anybody trying to make themselves look good by beating somebody else down. Yeah, that's what we need, nice radio. So understand this. If you come in, I take that to heart. That was a really good call. I wish that guy had been on the air. Are you feeling better already? Isn't it nice? It's nice to be nice. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Jim.
How are you? Great, I hope. Don't go, Adam. I miss you. Let's see. Stucknut says, time for the garden. Hashtag nice radio. Right, we're no longer a jungle. Jungle does not suggest niceness. Jungle would suggest the antithesis, the opposite of nice. It is the garden. That caller was right, Adam. I wish I knew his name and where he was from. We haven't been nice. Vic was not nice at all. Not to Ray Ratto, not to Jay Moore. Not to Brad, not to Caleb. Maybe I don't want Vic on the 21st. Anyway, it feels nice to be nice. Let's go to the phones. But understand, I'm going to hold you to a new standard. If you would like to participate in this garden, you be nice. This is nice radio. And I got the idea, the reminder from that caller who said to Adam Hawk, I don't appreciate those phone calls. It's a great show, but you don't need that. You're better than that. And he's right. We are better than that. So if you're going to call this show, you best be nice. Or something not nice might happen. Well, it won't be not nice, but you will not be welcome. That's not a nice way to put that either. Let's just say you need to be nice. Let's go to Los Angeles. Why, Matt? Hello, Matt. How are you?
Hey, Jim Rome. I wanted to be nice myself. You know, Victor in NoCal, it's not that he got kicked out of NoCal per se. I think it's that everybody started thinking of him and mistaking him for a busted up Steve Perry looking like he fell off an ugly tree and hit every branch on the way down.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Not a saying very good somebody call. Fell out of an ugly tree and hit every branch on the way down is not something I would consider nice, Matt. That was not nice. Matt, I'm not sure what it is you do not understand about nice radio.
Nice.
That
nice
doesn't work.
Radio.
If you can't be nice, you cannot participate. If you have nothing nice to say, Matt, from Redondo Beach to Rwanda, you're not coming on. But have a nice day, Matthew. Have a nice day and hello to the family. Hope things are going well for you at work. You look good. You look great. Always good to hear from a friend. 1-800-636-8686. Listen, when you make the statement that the show's not nice, the callers aren't nice, the host isn't nice, you're right. We need to be better. In fact, even myself in the past, I've said, do better. Do better. Well, I need to do better. And we all do. And by do better, I mean be nicer. Nice radio.
Nice,
God, it's a lovely day.
Nice radio.
Let's go to Orion, who's no longer in Waterford. Orion, hello. How are you?
Hello, Jimmy. Are you having a nice day?
I'm having a nice,
wonderful day. And on this wonderful, nice day, I just want to say, Victor, it's not nice to say that Caleb is fat, nor that Rick has a big head. Do you know what else isn't nice? The way I have treated you in all these scopes for the last month, running you out, making fun of you, insulting you, talking about how you walk on Broadway to make my money. Victor, that's not nice, and I just want to apologize for all the dark and evil smack that I have levied against you. It's not nice, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you're wandering around.
That's not a good call. No.
Orion?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
I'm sensing heavy sarcasm on your part. Sarcasm's not nice. I smelled snark. I question your authenticity, your sincerity, most of all, your niceness. I do hope all is well with you in Waterford or wherever it is you're living right now. But I'm on to you. That was tricky, but not nice. So we're not having that.
Nice radio.
I'm here to make the world a better place. I'm here to make all of us nicer. I'm here to host nice radio. If you're wondering what is going on here, if you're wondering what the hell is... Wait, that's a bad word. Shame on me. I'm sorry. Maybe I need a timeout. That was a bad word. I'm going to have to run myself.
That's not a good call. No.
A caller called up Adam Hawk and said, hey, listen, that's not nice. That's rude. A call like that should not be on the air. And rather than my lash out and hammer this guy, I agreed. And I thought that it was time to bring back nice radio. And I'm so glad I have.
Nice.
Would anybody
radio.
Else like to participate? 1-800-636-8686. Why don't we go to one of the nicest towns I know. Des Moines. I've been there. Lovely town. We go to Des Moines, Iowa. Andrew. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
James, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you, Andrew?
Well, I just wanted to call, and I know we're keeping with a not nice theme, and you may have touched on it, but Toronto getting after Kevin Durant getting hurt, that is certainly not nice. Shame on you, Toronto. I'm out.
Rack him. Well done, Andrew. I almost gave you a golden ticket, Andrew, because that was very nice. Pointing out how unnice Toronto was extremely nice of you. Well said. That was not nice. Those fans who cheered Kevin Durant as he lay on the ground, perhaps with a torn Achilles. You know, earlier in the program, at a different time, I might have gone in and said, you scumbags. But that's not nice. I can make my point without resorting to name calling. Scumbags. See, that's not nice. Old habits die hard. Let's just say you should not have done that. And you know you shouldn't have done that. You know it. Listen, do you not feel better about yourself already? Is everything not much better already? I know I feel better about me. Frankly, I don't know if this show's ever been so good. And let there be a lesson in that. You can be nice and still be great. Let's go to St. Louis. What a great time to be in St. Louis. An amazing time to be in St. Louis.
St. Louis.
Alvin, St. Louis is not nice. St. Louis is on the verge of a Game 7 and a Stanley Cup championship. So let's go to Mike in St. Louis. Hello,
Hi,
Mike.
Jim.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Are you having a nice day?
Oh, I most certainly am, Mike. Thank you for asking. How about you?
Oh, I am too. I'm a first-time caller. But I'd really like to wish the Boston Bruins fans a really, really nice day. Since they ruined our party on Game 6, we'd like to ruin theirs on Game 7.
Mike?
No.
You don't like that cup.
Ruin is not a word that should be in your vocabulary. Ruin does not suggest nice. Why would you want to ruin anything for anybody? You're not ready to play nice, Mike. So you're not ready for the jungle. We don't ruin parties here, Mikey. We don't ruin anything. So let's just make sure that first-time call is your last-time call, if you can't be nice. Anyway, just keep it nice. I'm here to be nice. I'm all about nice. Hey, look, let me tell you something. Thanks, Alvin. This show's not for everybody, all right? It's just not. It's not for everybody. I'm not for everybody. The show's not for everybody. Every once in a while, somebody's going to get their skull cracked.
Good night now!